Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Most of us are lucky enough we don't have to imagine going hungry. We pay for, prepare, and consume 3 squares a day. But a new poll shows 20% of the population, 20%, has at some point this year had at least one day where they were unable to put food on the table. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. This is your Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 23rd day of August. We spend a lot of time talking about how the economy affects all Americans. It has been a rough few years, and families young and old often struggle with the decision of whether or not to ask for help from the government. Right now, tens of millions of people rely on food stamps and school lunch programs. And a new survey out from Gallup shows 1 in 5 Americans has struggled at some point this year to pay for food.
And the latest poll number suggests margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Joining us now to talk about the survey is Frank Newport. He's the editor-in-chief at Gallup, and he's here for our regular attitude check to learn what Americans really think about things. Good to talk to you again, Frank.
Good to be with you.
So talk to us about the question that interviewers asked here about buying food and what the response was.
Yeah, it's a fascinating question, actually one that we have asked in countries around the world, and we track it daily here in the U.S. And basically we ask respondents, and amongst other questions, has there been at least one time in the past 12 months when you did not have enough money to buy the food that you or your family need? And overall, 18% of Americans so far this year, first half of this year, said yes, there has been at least one time. So a lot of Americans are struggling out there across this country.
The report also does point out some pretty stark regional differences, and we will put a map of that on our website at marketplace.org. But where are folks struggling the most?
If you look at the map, it's right across the southern tier of the U.S. The single state where it's highest is Mississippi. 25%, that is 1 out of 4 Mississippi residents, tell us over the last year there's been at least one occasion when they've struggled to have enough money to buy food. Following that are Alabama, Delaware, Georgia, Nevada, those states that I mentioned. All of those have above 20% who say they've struggled to be able to buy food.
Anywhere in the country where it's not an issue?
Well, you know, I keep mentioning this state, and it's North Dakota. A lot of our indices of consumer confidence, mm-hmm. job creation, you know, we all know you've seen the pictures of all the huge oil and gas
right.
boom repercussions going on up in North Dakota. Well, it certainly means that there are fewer people struggling to buy food. It's 10% in North Dakota. The other states where it's quite low are up there around North Dakota, kind of in that upper Midwest, South Dakota and Wisconsin, Minnesota, Montana.
You know, I'm curious, just if you could lift the curtain for us on something. When pollsters have to ask this question of the people who they're calling up, what's it like for them to get the answer of yes, I have had trouble putting food on the table?
Well, it can certainly be sad for an interviewer because basically they're hearing the respondent on the other end of the phone telling them that things are not going right at all in their life. And this isn't the only question we ask along these lines. We ask if you had medical problems, you currently have medical problems. And, of course, a lot of people are suffering in that dimension as well. But, you know, our interviewers probably have the biggest problems or reactions when we ask political questions because that's where, instead of just being sad, the respondents come back with very strong emotions on both sides of it, both sides of the equation. And our interviewers have to say, all right, I've got your answer down. Time to go on to the next question.
Your data also suggest that this issue of hunger is going to get worse later this year. Why is that?
Well, the drought, as we know, has caused problems in the farming and agriculture sector of this country, even including things like not enough water in the Mississippi for barges full of food to go down the river. So the anticipation is by experts that the price of food is going to go up, not down into the fall and into the winter. And, of course, if that's the case, it's likely that we'll have even more Americans who say, I just don't have enough money to buy food.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup, and he's been joining us for our weekly attitude check. Frank, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And as I mentioned, you can find the map and a state-by-state breakdown at marketplace.org. On Wall Street, stocks lost ground after the head of the Federal Reserve's St. Louis branch poured some cold water on the idea of more central bank help for the economy. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Young people are among the Americans most hurt by the Great Recession. The unemployment rate for 16 to 24-year-olds is more than double the national average. A lot of young workers are realizing that the path they thought would lead to a career, go to college, work hard, get a great job, well, it may not pan out. Today we kick off a series called Clocked In from our partners at Youth Radio. They're examining some of the new paths that young people are choosing. Here's reporter Sarah Quevedo.
Comedian Chris Rock has this great stand-up bit where he talks about working at Red Lobster as a teen, dishwashing in the back of the restaurant. His job was basically to scrape shrimp into trash cans all day. I've also worked as a dishwasher, so I know what it's like to come home stinking of hollandaise. Touching leftovers isn't even the worst part. What's worse, Rock says, is glancing up at the clock.
When you got a career, there ain't enough time in the day. There ain't enough time. When you got a job, there's too much time.
But these days, jobs, not careers, are what a lot of us are able to get.
She wanted me to reorganize the nail polishes in rainbow order.
My friend, Marlena Schoferwolf, used to work retail, and she'll never forget the moment she realized it was a dead end. It happened one Friday night after she'd already worked 9 hours, when her boss asked her to get all creative with the nail gloss.
It was just a box filled with nail polish, but it wasn't organized at all. Like, it was just a box with probably 1,000 nail polish shades in it. I dreamt of this for nights after because it was mindless work, and I want to do something where my brain is engaged, where I'm happy working, and where I'm not being taken advantage of.
Every young person I know has a story like this. And the question we all ask is, how do we go from sorting nail polish to actually earning a decent wage and maybe even liking our jobs without being crippled by college debt?
I myself feel torn about recommending young people to go to college.
Which is a little awkward for Stephanie Luce because she works at a college. She's a professor of labor studies at the City University of New York.
I believe higher education is, you know, very valuable just in its own right, but I really hate to have anyone take on that kind of debt.
Here's the problem. There are two competing realities for my generation. College is getting more expensive, and careers, they're just hard to come by.
Young people today are among the first generations in the history of the United States that cannot be assured of earning average wages higher than their parents.
Okay. So I don't know about you, but I find that kind of depressing. I'm 19, and like a lot of people my age, I spend most of my time thinking about the future. And it's not just me. I spoke to a bunch of my peers, and we're all anxious about what's next.
Right now, I don't really feel like what I'm passionate about is something that I could pursue as a career.
Trying to get a job with a high school diploma is hard. Won't nobody hire you.
I really gave up on jobs due to the fact of how hard it is to get them. They only paying you so little in order to take care of so much.
But there are employers, educators, and organizations that are coming up with solutions to address the skills gap and put young adults to work. Good news about the economy? That's something everyone, especially my peers, needs to hear right now. I'm Sarah Quevedo for Marketplace.
Our series Clocked In picks back up next week. It's produced by Youth Radio's New Options Desk, which reports on how young adults are finding work. Being unemployed in this economy has its obvious problems. What's not so obvious are the solutions. D.W. Gibson's new book, Not Working, is a collection of interviews with people who lost their jobs because of the recession, but they've also now found new ways to adapt. D.W., thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you traveled across the country and talked to people who had lost their jobs, and yet there is a lot of hope in this book. Were you surprised by that?
I was surprised by that, pleasantly surprised by that. And I think a lot of the hope is in folks that find a way to reconfigure their life, to sort of take a step back from where they were, and instead of looking for a way to slip right back into that slot where they were making X amount of dollars, to take a step back and look at what they can do to reclaim their life, the things they can do to save money and not necessarily live with less, but sort of reclaim the activities they do that define who they are.
Did some of that, though, depend on how long they had been unemployed, I would guess?
Yes, and I think that there are definitely a lot of stages, if you will, that people experience in their own timing. People talk about an initial optimism that they experience sort of in the immediate aftermath of a layoff. And then they sort of settle into something if it's been, you know, months and in some cases years. I think there's a total range of emotion that goes on for the long-term unemployed.
Well, we have one of your subjects also in studio with you, Bridget Lacey. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Talk to us about your layoff.
Well, what happened was I initially was a journalist at the News and Observer in Raleigh, and they were laying off. And so I was offered a position at state government. And I accepted that position as the media relations manager for the North Carolina Arts Council. I think a state government would be kind of safer than newspapers. So after 2 years and 6 months, I was then laid off as a part of RIF reduction in force.
You talk about going to an unemployment workshop and getting some pretty, shall we say, unhelpful advice. What was some of that?
Well, there was this little guy, and I always preface it with little because he was physically small, but I thought his mind was small, too, in that he was saying things like, you know, stop getting your hair done, don't go to the manicurist. And that just kind of felt like almost like comedic. It was like, that's not real advice. You know, if I have to choose between paying my credit card and my house note or my car note, what should I choose and why? I wanted more kind of hands-on advice like that that seemed practical.
Well, DW, based on your conversations with all these people all over the country, do we have an unemployment system that is helpful?
You know, it's funny. People across the board, whatever sort of political affinities they expressed, spoke about disappointment in political leadership across the spectrum, not about this party or that, across the spectrum. And articulated a hunger for a jobs program, an opportunity to receive support for the government that wasn't for the fact that they didn't have a job, but for the fact that they were doing a job that the government had given them. So there's a real appetite out there, I think, for a jobs program across the political spectrum within the citizenry. And that's what really stood out to me in a lot of these conversations.
Well, Bridget, do we have a happy ending for you?
Well, you know what? So far, it has been a happy ending, or maybe I say a new beginning.
Right, right.
Because, you know, when you were asking about resources in Raleigh, Wake Tech Community College offers what they call human resource development classes. And these classes are free for the unemployed and the underemployed. And I've been taking classes on online social media, LinkedIn. So there are a lot of great courses there to kind of help you revamp yourself or reinvent yourself.
So are you still searching for a full-time job?
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, best of luck with that.
Thank you.
D.W. Gibson is the author of Not Working, a series of stories from across the country of people who have been unemployed. And one of his subjects was Bridget Lacey, who has also joined us. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, the pros and cons of minimum wage.
I don't like the idea that people who work live below poverty conditions or even somewhat above poverty conditions. I think the question is, does a minimum wage actually help?
But first, let's do the numbers. Disappointing results and lowered forecasts hit stocks today. The Dow fell 115 points, 0.9% to finish at 13,057. The Nasdaq lost 20 points, 0.2%, closing at 3,053, and the S&P 500 shed 11 points, 0.8%, ending at 1,402. Hewlett-Packard fell 8% as PC sales slowed. The companies that make the chips inside PCs were also off, Intel by more than 2.5%, Advanced Micro Devices by more than 2.75%. The closeout retailer Big Lots had 20% knocked off after it reported lower-than-expected earnings and cut its forecast for the year. Guess was slashed 22% after announcing sales in its stores were down as well. Downgraded by an analyst predicting lower steel prices, U.S. Steel fell 7%. Its rival Nucor was off 3.5%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for July. A durable good should provide you more than 3 years of service. 1 year ago, Steve Jobs resigned as Apple CEO. And in 2006, our solar system was downsized to 8 planets when Pluto was demoted to dwarf planet. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Quick, name 10 different vaccines. Flu, hepatitis, measles, Okay, as of Monday, it may get a little easier to complete that list. That's when Walmart begins offering 10 different vaccines in nearly 3,000 stores. It's all part of a plan to turn shoppers into pincushions and inject more profits into the company's growing healthcare business. Dan Gorenstein of New Hampshire Public Radio reports.
Walmart will have vaccines for young people, whooping cough, chickenpox, and they'll have shots for old people, shingles.
Certainly, people are already going to Walmart to buy all kinds of things.
Joel Hay is a healthcare economist at the University of Southern California.
So if they're already going to be there, it'll add one more convenient aspect to be able to get vaccines and perhaps other types of healthcare services delivered through Walmart.
Chains like CVS and Walmart and Walgreens started getting into healthcare services a decade ago, and it's worked out fairly well. Walmart's health business, including over-the-counter drugs, brought in 11% of the company's sales last year. Temple University pharmacy professor Albert Wertheimer believes Walmart will follow its competitors and keep expanding.
They'll have dental offices, and you can make an appointment and get your routine teeth cleaning. And then next will be, you know, a physician or a physician's assistant. Walgreens has that Take Care, and CVS has one.
Walmart says it'll offer vaccines at a deep discount, and that, says Lori Usher Pines, a researcher with RAND, will probably be enough to push more people to roll up their sleeves, especially as healthcare reform kicks in and primary care offices get overloaded.
There's concerns that that system will be even further strained, so this might be an ideal setting to obtain a vaccination.
But you know what? It's not even Labor Day. There's still a couple months till flu season starts. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
United Airlines is about to make some not-so-friendly changes for your knees. The carrier is joining several other rivals by installing slimmer seats on some of its planes in the coming year. Southwest and Alaska already announced similar moves. The carriers have been promoting more room underneath for carry-ons, and they say the lighter materials that these seats use will save on fuel costs. Of course, it also means they can add a row of passengers by scrunching everybody in a little tighter. And that's got our 6'4" senior business correspondent Bob Moon imagining what it'll be like the next time he flies.
Ladies and gentlemen, please place your knees in their upright and locked position.
Okay, so I doubt it'll be quite so official, but industry analysts say we can expect more airlines to try squeezing in even more paying customers. George Hobica is the founder of AirfareWatchdog.com.
It's all about saving fuel and cramming more passengers into each aircraft.
Oh, sure, the carriers are claiming the thin seats actually give people more personal space between armrests, but Hobica has tried them and says he misses the days when plain seats were more like lazy boys and not like church pews.
They are less comfortable. There's absolutely no question. They are harder and they have less give. They are closer together, and your only option is to fork over the cash for those premium economy seats at the front of the plane or use your miles to upgrade to business class or first class.
Or, he says only half jokingly, suffer And given the option of cheaper seats, most of us will suffer through. So says industry analyst Henry Hartfelt at Atmosphere Research Group. But isn't this really a safety issue? Hartfelt says not as long as the airline proves it can evacuate the plane within federal time limits.
Spirit Airlines, which has the smallest amount of legroom of any U.S. airline, 28 inches, got that seating approved by the FAA.
Hartfelt says as long as we all keep buying the cheap seats, the carriers will keep giving us what we seem to want.
Airlines are not in the passenger happiness business. Their job is to move as many people as they can safely and to make a profit.
So who knows if we'll ever again hear ads beckoning us to fly the friendly skies. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
This week, our Wealth and Poverty Desk has been exploring what we're paid and why.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
Today in our series, Payday, we head down to the bottom of the paycheck ladder for a closer look at the minimum wage. That's the pay scale for around 1 in 20 American workers. Congressional Democrats have introduced a bill to raise the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $9.80 an hour. It's not expected to make much headway this year, but it's got a lot of people talking about the pros and cons of the idea. Wealth and Poverty reporter Chrissy Clark took two economists to the heart of minimum wage country to have them hash it out.
To get to minimum wage country, I didn't have to go far.
I'm at the Pizza Hut.
What?
I'm at the Taco Bell.
What?
I'm at the combination Pizza Hut and Taco Bell.
The kind of funny-sounding fast-food hybrid that's the subject of this definitely funny song happens to be owned by one of the largest employers of minimum wage workers in the country. Yum Brands Incorporated is the parent company of
Pizza Hut
and
Taco Bell.
Its U.S. workforce is more than 800,000 strong.
Hey, you're mandatory?
Yeah.
Including Liz, according to her name tag.
Can I have the Cinnabon Delights?
She took my order at the combination Pizza Hut and Taco Bell near my house in L.A.
Anything else for you?
I asked the restaurant supervisor what the starting hourly rate is for a job like Liz's.
For a regular team member, it's a minimum wage.
Which, at current levels, means that if Liz was supporting a family of three, she'd be below the poverty line. Now, Taco Bell says they pay competitive salaries and provide training so people like Liz can move up. But what would happen to Liz, to her customers, to this Pizza Hut Taco Bell's bottom line if the minimum wage was raised? I invited two people who think a lot about that kind of question.
Hi, Bob. Hi, Chrissy.
But see it in very different lights.
Hi, David. Chrissy.
To, through the magic of radio, come join me at this Pizza Hut and Taco Bell for a little minimum wage throwdown. In one corner, we have Bob Polin, an economist at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. I asked him for his order.
Have a burrito.
And for his basic perspective on the minimum wage.
We should have a minimum wage that enables everybody, including all the people at the Pizza Hut and Taco Bell, to lead a minimally decent life.
In the other corner is David Newmark, an economist at the University of California, Irvine.
I don't like the idea that people who work live below poverty conditions or even somewhat above poverty conditions. I think the question is, does a minimum wage actually help?
And his order?
Since this is an invisible meal and I'm not eating it, I'll take a large pepperoni pizza and an extra large Coke.
And in fact, David says one of his main concerns about raising minimum wage is actually illustrated by Liz, the cashier's response when I order that extra large Coke. She says this.
I'm going to give you the Coke.
And points to a self-serve drink dispenser.
You can take whatever.
Okay. Turns out this moment, David says, is quite possibly an effect of past increases in the minimum wage.
When I was a kid and you ordered soda, a person had to stand there with the finger on the button until the glass filled up. And now in many fast food restaurants, of course, they've completely eliminated any labor involved with pouring the soda.
And soda by soda, that can add up to eliminating a job.
And minimum wages can accelerate these kind of changes.
Because, David argues, if a company has to pay people more, they'll find ways to pay fewer people. If we raise the minimum wage today and came back to this Pizza Hut Taco Bell in 6 months?
My prediction, based on lots and lots of research, is that there'd be somewhat less employment at that restaurant.
Of course, David cautioned,
Economists have been wrong once or twice before about their theories.
Not you, though.
At this point, Bob, the other economist, couldn't help himself. He had to jump in. First of all, Bob pointed out, the academic research is split on whether raising the minimum wage actually raises unemployment in any significant way. For one thing, he says there are alternative ways a fast food joint might offset the extra costs of higher wages.
The prices of the products could go up, and you will also see some reduction in the profits of the business owners.
And he says you can't ignore all the good things a minimum wage bump can do for the workers themselves. Bob surveyed nearly 100 people who've been affected by past minimum wage increases. He asked what changed in their lives.
You don't have to work three jobs. You only have to work two jobs. Or they can get a car, a used car, or they can at least get their car repaired. They can buy groceries for elderly parents. Those are meaningful things.
And Bob argues because businesses are investing more money in their workers, turnover tends to drop, too.
You get people operating at a higher level of productivity. That improves relations between managers and workers. You essentially change the nature of the work relationship when you pay people decently.
Bob and David sparred a bit more over raising the minimum wage. Bob pointed out that if you adjust for inflation, minimum wage is actually lower now than it was 40 years ago. David asked, who really benefits from a higher minimum wage? Poor families or the many middle-class teenagers who work low-wage part-time jobs? One of the few things they could both agree on about minimum wage?
It is not a cure-all to poverty. In fact, the biggest source of low-income poverty is the fact that people don't have jobs at all.
I absolutely agree with that.
Finally, some consensus.
Hello. Okay.
Hi, you're back.
I asked Liz, the woman behind the Pizza Hut Taco Bell counter, what she thought about all this, but she couldn't talk. She was on the clock. As for David and Bob, they were, of course, in different parts of the country, so they couldn't actually eat the pizza and burrito they'd ordered through the magic of radio. But I could.
Okay, for your 2 minutes.
For here.
I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, if you've ever wished for some sort of lie detector for the campaign trail, enter the Super PAC app. It's the brainchild of former students from MIT's Media Lab. You download it, turn on the TV, find a political ad, and the app tells you who paid for that ad and where to find out whether what the ad says is true. Let's just hope they don't make one that can tell whether you're lying about your weight. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 115 points, 0.9%. The Nasdaq fell 20 points, 0.2%. And the S&P 500 dropped 11 points, 0.8%. Our editors include John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.